Ladies and gentlemen, let's begin. Welcome to the fifth day of the inaugural Festival of Ideas. My name's Dr. Chris McAuliffe, and I'm here to introduce and chair our session on the rise of Chinese contemporary art. As we begin, some of you will be familiar with the housekeeping announcements, but we'll repeat them on at every event. Please turn off your mobile phones. I'll say that again. Please turn off your mobile phones. There's always someone who's on their mobile phone while that announcement is being made, and they forget. This session, including the question and answer session at the end, is being filmed and recorded, and in future, next week, the recordings will be available on the festival website for you to reference. Before I introduce our two speakers, just a couple of comments on by way of background and format. It's interesting to me that my first encounter with Chinese contemporary art came in 1994 at an exhibition entitled Post Mao Product at the Ballarat Fine Art Gallery, and it was curated by one of our speakers, Claire Roberts. An exhibition such as that suggests an early interest in Chinese contemporary art on the part of Australian scholars and curators, and I think an openness to the new art from China on the part of galleries and museums. And I thought it was particularly telling that Ballarat, with a powerful history of Chinese culture through the Gold Rush era, took that show 15 years ago. And that interest has grown through major events such as the Asia-Pacific Triennial and numerous cultural exchanges, many of them organised by AsiaLink, of course, as you know, housed in this building. And globally, that rise of contemporary Chinese art has been phenomenal. Paintings in that 1994 exhibition, listed then as Collection of the Artist, very soon after entered major international collections and now change hands for vast sums, sums that Australian artists can only dream of. Some of those artists have been considered world historical figures, even likened to Van Gogh. Perhaps that's market hyperbole, but that's the kind of parallels that are being drawn. And that market registers another astounding characteristic of contemporary Chinese art. In 2007, 5 of the 10 best-selling living artists at auction were Chinese-born, placing Chinese artists alongside the likes of Damien Hirst and Gerhard Richter. So that is a thumbnail sketch of the impact, but our two speakers will address the topic in much more detail. Jeremy Barmet is an Australian Research Council Federation Fellow based at the Australian National University, an historian, a cultural critic, a filmmaker and a web archivist who works on Chinese cultural and intellectual history from the early modern period through to the present. Claire Roberts is a senior curator in Asian arts and design at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney and a research fellow with Jeremy Barmet's Australian Research Council Federation Fellowship Project at the Australian National University. Because we only have two speakers, we are going to rotate. Jeremy will speak, then Claire, then Jeremy, then Claire. It's an ABAB structure, which will move from introduction to detail and then on to the future. And at the conclusion of those that elegant rhythm, you from the floor will be able, I might say almost Cartesian rhythm, we'll invite questions from you on the floor. And I've warned our speakers that as this is the fifth day, there are many of you there who have been nurturing questions since Monday or Tuesday, which I'm sure will come out with great gusto. So, Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you for that kind, near-philosophical introduction. The date 1978 is related to China's present phase of development, a political moment it is, when China's open door and reform process began, initiated by the Chinese Communist Party. So today, I will, rather than trying to look back at the vast and complex history of 20th century Chinese art and its development. We'll take that date and remark first on the art and cultural developments that are very much ordained by the political history of China in the last 30 years, because that gives us some context, perhaps, to go into Claire's more detailed discussion of artists and trends and actual artwork. So mine's a verbal presentation, no striking images or any of the fascinating and important work that has made up the extraordinary transformation of the Chinese cultural image internationally in the last 30 years, and particularly in the last 15 years or so. As many of you may realize, this year in the People's Republic of China is a year heavy with anniversaries. Commentators both in and outside China have observed that 2009 is the 60th anniversary of New China. It is also a date that completes one cycle of the traditional Chinese calendar, the Jiazi. This is a false understanding of time in Chinese terms, but nonetheless, people comment that this is a period of both completion and renewal and possible further dramatic change. And regardless of how one views the calendar, traditional Chinese or Western, this year is one weighty with remembrance. It is also a significant year for modern Chinese art because it's a year that commemorates extraordinary developments in contemporary Chinese art that date from 1979 and also 1989, about which I'll say a few words and Claire also will refer to in her discussion. As you know, on October the 1st this year, China's National Day, the Chinese state will celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. That day will be marked in particular by a lavish parade, a grand parade that is being orchestrated and designed by a team led by, in name at least, led by one of the people who first came to prominence in China as part of the cultural avant-garde of the 1980s. That's a man by the name of Zhang Yimou, a film director who is noted most recently as one of the creative team behind the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics. Yimou is also designing this year's National Day, formal National Day celebrations on the evening of October the 1st. He is joined by one of China's most famous internationally recognized artists, a man by the name of Cai Guoqiang, whose work was first introduced in Australia many years ago. And Lao Cai, as he's known to all of us, is in charge of, again, notionally, he's not the only person, but he's always named as being the leading figure because he's a brand in his own right these days. He will design with the team the lavish pyrotechnical display that will be featured in Beijing on the night of October the 1st. And so we see just in these two figures the coalition of the state, priorities of the state, or the nation state and the Communist Party state, with elements of the Chinese avant-garde. There's been much debate about how these particular artists and many other Chinese artists and creators have been co-opted or become involved with the nation state over the last couple of years. In fact, if one looks at the evolution of modern and contemporary Chinese art over the last 30 years, and we don't have the time to go into the details of it, but I can assure you this type of strange devil's dance or Apache dance between the Chinese authorities and the avant-garde artists, whether it be filmmakers or writers, poets, novelists, and also artists who work in the plastic arts, performing arts, or oils, has been going on for over 25 years. In the West, because once the Americans began discovering contemporary art in the last 10 years or so, they felt that this is some great development, something quite new and unique. As usual, our American cousins are a little bit behind time. The year 2009 also marks other significant anniversaries in the Chinese world. Some of these will be commemorated, such as the 1st of October, with due pomp and circumstance. Others, those events best described as what I call dark anniversaries, will pass by or have passed by in an atmosphere of heightened alertness, security cordons, crackdowns, and official anxiety. These dark anniversaries, as many of you will know, include such things as the uprising in Lhasa in 1959, the closing down of the Xidan Democracy Wall in 1979, the tragic events of June 1989, and the violent and grim religious repression after April 1999. That's the repression of the Falun Gong movement. They all offer the other various stories and a contentious heritage. They play their own role in the unsteady growth of the strong, unitary modern state, and also in the constant and strange topography of contemporary Chinese art and culture. These years and days, both the light and the dark anniversaries offer a penumbra of history. They stand in shaded contrast to the vaunted moments of commemoration, those anniversaries which bask in the merciless glare of publicity and enjoy official largesse. Although formally ignored or recalled only in verso, these dark anniversaries cast a gloomy shadow of the orchestrated sans lumière of state occasions. These doppelgangers of dead anniversaries haunt the living, and many Chinese artists and cultural practitioners in their work and in their conversation about Chinese culture discuss them constantly. As we know, June 1989 marked a devastating massacre in Beijing with the repression of the mass democracy movement, a movement that aimed, among other things, to just force the Chinese authorities to engage in a meaningful dialogue with dissenting, unhappy, unsettled, protesting individuals, students, workers, and even state bureaucrats. They demanded and called for what was called duihua. For those of you familiar with contemporary Chinese art, you'll know that a couple of months before the appalling repression of June 89, there was a major Chinese art exhibition. The exhibition that led directly to some of the international world's interest in Chinese art and culture. That exhibition was held in February 1989 at the China National Art Gallery. It was sort of a summing up of the last previous 10 years of artistic experimentation and avant-garde investigation of the visual culture. It was a show that offered a retrospective of work that had first appeared in 1979. Claire will touch on some of that work, The Stars, who first appeared in 79. It also offered a reflection of some of the leading avant-garde artists active in 1984, 5, 6, 7, and 8. These are artists, some of whom have gone on to mega-stardom internationally, many of whom were challenging the state, challenging the accepted norms of the party state and the narratives of official Chinese culture. There was also a wonderful element of anarchic performance in that exhibition in 1989. One artist sold threw prawns around the gallery, selling them and hawking them, saying that after all, art is just another product to be sold and grabbed and hawked at the bourse of commodities. He's, of course, proved prescient in particular in the way the Chinese art has been received internationally. Another scattered condoms on the floor, and a third, a woman, shot a gun at her own work. Her artwork itself was called Duihua, or dialogue. It was a prescient act pretending the grim events that would follow a couple of months later. The art of the 1980s, which has only belatedly been more formally recognized in China in the last 2 or 3 years, was an explosive expression of the cultural and intellectual diversity that had been simmering in the country for decades. In fact, the art of the 80s also gave expression to a type of art that had been hidden, and indeed until about 2 years ago, remained hidden in China for a very long time indeed. And again, Claire will touch on that work, the work of a group of artists known as the no-name artists, or the Wuminghua Shou. Artists who long before Chinese art became fashionable were pursuing their own individualistic and unique visions of the world. Again, that's art has only been recognized in China very belatedly, and the international market, I fear, has not yet recognized it. I would also note, as Chris did, that Australian scholars, curators and collectors have been involved with and aware of contemporary and avant-garde Chinese art since the 1980s, long before it became the flavor of the international art market. And it is important to remember that Australia has played a very particular type of role in cataloguing, engaging with, and displaying contemporary Chinese art for over 25 years. So this is not, we're talking about something today that we've actually been involved with for a very long time indeed. Just in closing these opening remarks, I'll say that it's also worth remembering that this year commemorates the 50th anniversary of a speech that Chairman Mao gave in 1959, a speech aimed against the West. It was very much focused against what the American Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, had called the possible peaceful evolution of communist countries like China and the Soviet Union into something more open, related to the international environment, culturally aware and engaged. This project of peaceful evolution was one that Chairman Mao regarded as being particularly dangerous to the Chinese nation state. Why this anniversary this year is relevant is that those of you who know what happened after June the 4th, 1989, will know that Deng Xiaoping himself said the greatest danger to China was a peaceful evolution that has been harbored by the West and as part of a strategy and a plot to corrupt Chinese culture, Chinese political and other institutions, and turn China into a vassaldom of the West. It is interesting as we consider the evolution of contemporary Chinese art that the peaceful evolution that has taken place is one that has seen a strange and symbiotic melding of the international art market with Chinese artistic practice. And as we remember Chairman Mao's warnings about the corruption and decay of China, we also can recognize the possibility of change and development and evolution in China itself. And with those remarks, I shall hand over to Claire.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you, Chris, and it's nice to be here, and thank you all for coming. This is the visual part of the presentation, and I'll pick up on a number of the artists and events that Jeremy's referred to and show you some of the works that they actually produced. So I, too, am starting in 1978, using that as the beginning of what I'm referring to as the period of contemporary Chinese art, or the beginning of what we think of as contemporary Chinese art. Because it was in 1978 that Deng Xiaoping announced what he called the open door policy, welcoming foreign business into China in order to improve the country's economic future. This policy was part of a broader movement of social liberalization following the chaos and extremism of the Cultural Revolution. Artists took advantage of these winds of change and explored contemporary modes of expression, experimenting with a variety of different styles and media. Few could have predicted that 30 years on, works by some Chinese artists would sell at auction for $9 million and up, and that Chinese artists would move to New York, Paris, and Sydney, many in the wake of the trauma of the June the 4th massacre in 1989, and go on to achieve international success. Over the next 20 minutes, I will look back on Chinese experimental art of the last 30 years and consider the significance of key works, beginning with a brief introduction to the present. I'd like you to consider what individual artworks might tell us about the artist and his or her relationship to contemporary society, and how the art and the art making has changed over time. While we don't have any time to explore these questions in any depth, we can begin to reflect on some of the reasons behind the recent rise of global interest in contemporary Chinese art. So first of all, a quick snapshot of the situation over the past year. The Beijing Olympics, launched on the 8th of August 2008, was in many ways a watershed event, announcing China's arrival on the international stage. The opening and closing ceremonies, as Jeremy has said, created by the internationally acclaimed film director Zhang Yimou, with help from pyrotechnic artist Cai Guoqiang, and hundreds of performers from the Chinese Army's elite performance troops lend themselves to detailed cultural and semiotic analysis. The 3D imaging technology that you see in this slide, used to carry strong cultural and contemporary narratives, was an impressive display of China's emerging creative industries. But the formal raising of the Chinese flag within the stadium, in much the same way as it is carried out each morning in Tiananmen Square on the flagpole facing the portrait of Mao Zedong, left no ambiguity about who was in control. The Games was a showcase for the People's Republic of China and its dramatically remodeled capital. It was a careful and orchestrated demonstration of national confidence. In the years leading up to the Olympics, people all over the world began to take more notice of China as its economy grew to surpass that of Germany and become the third largest in the world. The international fascination with Chinese art, notably contemporary art, must be seen in this larger context of China's economic and political engagement with the world. A striking illustration of this interest may be found in the global edition of the New York Times that I'm showing you here from the 21st and 22nd of June in 2008. Every one of the 17 exhibitions listed in the Arts Guide for museums and galleries around the world related to China, and 7 focused on contemporary Chinese art and design. But global sentiment has changed dramatically over the last 8 months. Colleen Ryan, writing in the Australian Financial Review in March this year, remarked, and I quote, "The two-year Chinese bubble, Chinese art bubble, has burst from the pressure of oversupply." End of quote. Works by leading artists are now failing to reach earlier highs. Galleries are closing in the fashionable 798 Art District, and many of the artists lured to Beijing are returning to their hometowns, where the cost of living is much cheaper. Lin Chun-Yen, who created this work titled Self-Portrait, Opening the Door, in 1989, it was created just prior to his departure for Australia. Lin was one of the many artists then to return to Beijing to participate in the art boom. He now carries an Australian passport and has a studio in the artist village of Songjiang, where Ryan reported an estimated 30% of artists had left. And he said in that article, "It's much quieter here now than in recent years. Some galleries have gone bankrupt or closed down. Studios are looking for tenants. But this situation has a positive side for artists. Artists can calm down and make better works." So what I want to do now is give you a very quick historical overview of some of the key works through which we can begin to chart a pathway back to the present. All of the works that I've selected are by influential artists. They're visually striking, they're thought-provoking, and in some cases, shocking. Each of them pushes the boundary of official acceptability at the time. And I wanted to start with this modest oil painting by Zhao Wenliang, who was part of an amateur painting group in Beijing that Jeremy mentioned called No Name. Zhao depicts shadows cast by trees outside the 15th century tomb of the Ming Dynasty emperor, Yongle. The reverse, and I've included that on the slide, is inscribed, and I quote, "Zhao, made on the 18th of August 1966. Afterwards, the bloody terror of Red August occurred. From that time, we ceased painting for 45 days. On the 2nd of October, I took up the brush again. This painting has been stored in my portable painting case for close to 10 years, end of quote. It was painted on the day that Mao Zedong reviewed the Red Guards in Tiananmen Square, an event that signaled the beginning of the great proletarian cultural revolution. Small enough to be hidden in a bag, it is one of hundreds of landscapes and still life paintings, paintings that at the time were regarded as bourgeois and counter-revolutionary, that were made by the no-name artists over the course of three decades as a form of passive resistance to the political chaos that was unfolding around them. In July of 1979, the group held their first exhibition in a public venue, attracting large crowds. It was the first wild or non-official exhibition held in Beijing following the end of the Cultural Revolution. 3 months later, the first Stars Group exhibition was held on the railings of the park adjacent to the National Art Museum of China, also mentioned by Jeremy. Included in the exhibition was Silence, which is on your right, by Wang Keping, another self-taught artist who made what he described absurdist sculpture, inspired by the French theatre of the absurd from found pieces of wood. The sculpture on the left, titled Idol, is the first experimental artwork that dared to use Mao Zedong as its subject. The artist Wang Keping intended it to be displayed in the exhibition, but it was considered too politically sensitive at the time. The exhibition was closed down after 2 days, and the artists organized a demonstration to uphold the constitution and the ideals of democracy and artistic freedom. It was the time of the democracy wall movement. In 1981, Wang Keping married a French woman and then moved to Paris. Around the same time, and we're still in 1979, artists were commissioned to create murals for the new Beijing International Airport, new then. Artists included Yuan Yunsheng, who'd graduated from the Central Academy of Fine Arts, China's leading art academy in Beijing, in 1962. And after the chaos and trauma of the Cultural Revolution, he returned to teach there from 1978. The murals were inspired by the water festival in Xishuangbanna in Yunnan province in southern China and reflected the cultural practices of the Dai people. They became controversial because Yuan depicted naked women whose bodies were elongated. It was covered up with a curtain and then boarded over during a socialist morality campaign in 1981. Soon thereafter, Ye Yinsheng accepted an invitation to visit the United States, where he lived until his return to China in 1996. This huge canvas, titled Father, was displayed in the second National Youth Arts Exhibition at the National Art Museum of China in Beijing in 1980. In order to make it into the hang, the artist was advised by an official to add a ballpoint pen above the right ear of the farmer, which you can just see, to indicate that he was a new kind of socialist peasant. Lord Zhongli did so, and the painting was awarded the gold medal. Lord Zhongli acknowledges the inspiration of American photorealist artists. He was looking at the time for a style that would convey the ongoing poverty and difficulty of peasant life. Works like this combine elements of scar or wounded art and what was termed rustic realism. It was art that sought to critique society. And this 1983 work by Shang Yang, titled Yellow Earth Mother, is something of a companion to Lord Zhongli's Father, another example of rustic realism. Second State, this work by Geng Jianyi, a graduate of the Zhejiang Academy of Fine Arts in Hangzhou, China's second most prestigious art academy, shows us a very different kind of figuration. Geng Jianyi was part of the 1985 New Wave art movement, and his work made in 1987, this work is part of a triptych. Second State displays humor, but the smile or laugh is forced. The colors are cool, and there is no background or context. It's an image of contradiction and an expression of ambivalence that has been described as gray humor. Zhang Pei Li, who did this video work, is also from Hangzhou and the Hangzhou Academy, a graduate from the oil painting department. This is a still from a video work titled 30 by 30 and was made in 1988. It's an early conceptual art video showing footage of a piece of mirror glass that's broken and put back together, filmed from a fixed viewpoint and repeated until the tape ends, suggesting boredom and futility. Another important work from 1988 is Mao Zedong No. 1 by Wang Guangyi, who founded the Northern Art Group in Harbin, to the north of Beijing. Wang rejected emotive painting styles and employed cool colors and what was termed a rational painting style. Mao Zedong No. 1 was included in the 1989 China Avant-Garde exhibition that Jeremy mentioned, held at the National Art Museum of China in 1989, and attracted incredible interest. Here, Wang depicts Mao underneath a photographer's grid, or is he behind bars? This is a work by Huang Yongping, and it's titled A History of Chinese Painting and a Concise History of Modern Painting, Washed in a Washing Machine for 2 Minutes. It's a conceptual work from 1987 and was also included in the landmark China Avant-Garde exhibition. Huang is also from the Hangzhou Art Academy and pursued non-expressive art to distinguish his work from the dominant trend of self-expression at the time. He was from Xiamen in Fujian and the leader of the Xiamen Dada group. The act of washing was intended to destroy, to cleanse, to purify, to create something new. A book from the sky, the title of the work you see here, was also included in the China Avant-Garde exhibition in 1989. It's a monumental work, and this was one of the works that was included in the exhibition that Chris mentioned that was held at Ballarat. It's one of the largest and most impressive installations of the period, a technical tour de force. Each Chinese character carved by hand from woodblock, but completely illegible. It's breathtaking in its beauty and its audacity. For Xu Bing, the act of creating this work, which was meaningless, was part of a process of forgetting following an intense period, he said, of reading Western art history, theory, and philosophy in translation. It is also a critique of the power of language that lies at the heart of Chinese culture. And this is a detail showing the individual books and the characters that look like characters but cannot be read by any Chinese person. This pencil drawing by Feng Li Jun was also in the landmark 1989 exhibition. It's one of a series of works that were intended to be made into lithographs, but never happened because of the June the 4th massacre. Feng works from photographs of himself and his friends, but in the process he de-individualises figures. These works in monochrome were seen to be expressive of the feelings of a generation of disillusioned or lost youth. Liu Xiaodong's Smoker, painted in 1988, was also in the China Avant-Garde exhibition. I'm showing you all these because they're important paintings and artworks, but also many of them are now in collections in Australia. We're fortunate to have them. Liu depicts people from his immediate milieu, in this case a movie director, part of the new west-leaning urban elite, who stands as a striking contrast to the worker seated in the shadow on the bed. Liu has painted the close confines of a dormitory room with a standard lamp, suggesting that it had been a long night of smoking, talking, and passing time. And this is the work Dialogue that Jeremy mentioned, created by Xiao Lu, who's one of the few female artists in China with a high profile in the world of Chinese avant-garde art, a world that has been very closely controlled by men. The installation titled Dialogue was her graduation work from the Hangzhou Art Academy and was a central work in the China Avant-Garde exhibition. Xiao Lu fired a gunshot into this work in the National Art Museum of China, which caused the exhibition to be closed. She and her partner were eventually arrested, and they later made their way to Australia. It is said that the gunshot, an act of defiance on the part of the artist, presaged the violence of June the 4th. Artists responded to the events of the June the 4th massacre in very private and deeply felt ways. This work by Zhang Xiaogang was made in the month after the June the 4th massacre. He was living then in Sichuan and was plunged into crisis. In an artist talk in Brisbane recently, he spoke of being woken from a dreamlike sleep with the realization that he could no longer separate himself from reality. He titled this work Reincarnation, and he portrays deathly white disembodied figure and body parts, an open book, shrouds, shadows, in black and white, the colours of death and mourning. And this was Yu Han's response to the massacre from Shanghai, a bicycle decorated with brightly coloured floral motifs and the ironic inscription, "Riding this flowery bicycle, it is as if the road ahead is paved in brocade," alluding perhaps to the bravery and the naivety of students who rode their bicycles into the square to participate in the protest movement in the name of democracy, many of whom never returned. In the years that followed, the mood continued to be somber. This is a 1992 painting by Feng Li Jun, whose pencil drawing I showed you earlier, with a figure modelled on himself in the foreground, yawning or yelling, and a row of zombie-like figures in the background, an example of cynical realism, a term that was coined by the curator and art historian Li Xianting. In this work by Zhang Huan from 1994, a performance that was filmed and photographed, the focus is on the body, the environment, and human endurance. On a hot afternoon, the artist sat naked in a public toilet in the East Village, an artist colony or artist area. He smeared himself in honey and fish oil. After 2 hours, he then walked into a polluted pond, leaving the flies to fight for their lives. More shocking is Siamese Twins from 2000 by Sun Yuan and Peng Yu. It was included in an exhibition titled Fuck Off, curated by Ai Weiwei and Feng Boyi in 2000 and timed to coincide with the first Shanghai Biennale held at the Shanghai Art Museum. Peng Yu and Sun Yuan, who can be seen in the background of this photograph, created a number of works in this vein. The previous year, Sun Yuan had exhibited a tiny fetus on a bed of ice in an exhibition called Post-Sense Sensibility, Alien Bodies and Delusion. The artist and critic Cho Jijie described post-sensibility as revenge without pain, or a kind of feeling without a subject. The works intended to shock audiences were inspired by the Sensation exhibition of young British artists, which first took place in 1997 at the Royal Academy in London. A feeling of shock and powerlessness about the rapidity of urban change has inspired the work of Zhang Dali. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, Zhang sprayed painted profiles of himself all over Beijing on buildings that were identified for demolition. The violence and pathos of this image, with the tiles of the roof of an imperial building visible beyond, and the personal marking of his own by graffiti, represents a desperate attempt to remember the past and draw attention to its passing. Yang Fudong, who created this work, is one of China's leading film and video artists. This is one of three photographs from a series titled The First Intellectual. It was also included in the Fuck Off exhibition in 2000. In this disjointed narrative work, a well-dressed urban intellectual has been wounded, presumably struck by a falling brick. He wants to respond, but does not know who or what to vent his anger at. The work suggests the alienation of urban intellectuals, confused and powerless in a rapidly changing society. And finally, we're back to 2008 and the Beijing Olympics, a showcase for China's sporting elite, but also for some of her most internationally acclaimed creative figures, notably Ai Weiwei, who created the Fuck Off exhibition, who has been described as the architectural curator of the Bird's Nest Stadium that you see here, and Cai Guoqiang, mentioned by Jeremy, the visual director, the director of visual and special effects for the opening and closing ceremonies. Ai Weiwei was included in the Stars exhibition that I mentioned in 1979 and 1980, and moved to the USA in 1981, where he lived for more than a decade. He was one of the first Chinese to leave China, and then he was one of the first to return in 1993. Cai Guoqiang, on the other hand, left China in 1986. He lived in Japan until 1995, and thereafter in New York. He now divides his time between Beijing and New York. He came to international attention through his projects for extraterrestrials using gunpowder in order, and these are the words from his website, to foster spontaneity and to confront the suppression that he felt from the controlled artistic tradition and social climate in China at the time. A Cai Guoqiang retrospective was held at the Guggenheim Museum in New York in February 2008, and then traveled with some modifications to the National Art Museum of China in Beijing in August at the time of the Olympics. Over the last 2 years, remarkable prices have been realized for works by artists such as Cai Guoqiang, Zhang Xiaogang, Feng Lijun, and Yue Minjun, who's pictured here on the front cover of Our Good Weekend magazine in July 2008. It has mostly been European and American collectors, dealers and investors, and museums buying the works. A small percentage of the collectors have been Chinese speculators who quickly left the market as soon as it began to contract. Those artists who've made big money have invested it in real estate, in luxury cars, in restaurants and hotels. This is a view of Yue Minjun's compound in Beijing, designed like a courtyard house with high walls containing a huge studio, living space, gardens, gallery and reception area. And this is his studio, giving you an idea of the scale of the building and also of the paintings. In October 2007, this work by Yue Minjun, titled Execution, was sold by Sotheby's for $6 million. Yue had sold the painting first in 1995. What are we to make of its subject? A mock execution with those in the firing line wearing only underpants and fixed smiling faces. And its apparent reference to Goya's The 3rd of May, 1808, the execution of the defenders of Madrid. When asked about the reference to Tiananmen Square and the June the 4th massacre, Yue denied that he was criticizing the government and said, and I quote, "The laughs illustrate my deep feelings. One might be very happy now, but always unsure of what's going to happen next. I was trying to express the confusion over what I see. And this, the last work that I'll show you, is a recent installation by the same artist, Yue Mingjun, exhibited at the Shanghai Biennale late last year, comprising 41 dinosaurs, sporting Yue Mingjun's signature laughing face. The longest is 31 metres. The installation was received by visitors to the gallery as a bit of light-hearted fun, like something that you might find in a theme park, and was a chosen backdrop for many commemorative photographs. So I'm going to leave the historical overview here in late 2008 and hand over to Jeremy for more of his views on the rise of contemporary Chinese art before coming back and sharing with you some speculative remarks on the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. In these remarks, I'll just offer a few observations on so-called Chinese avant-garde art in the international world of exhibition and marketing, and also offer a few thoughts of my own on the individual and the future. I'd all remark that Yue Mingjun's work is also eagerly sought after by non-Western collectors and non-Chinese collectors. I have a friend whose Indonesian name is Budi Tek, and his Chinese name is Yudo Yao. A trader in teaks and hardwoods who grew up in Indonesia. He's bought tens of millions of dollars worth of Yue Mingjun's works. He has, according to his colleagues and friends, spent $4 billion on Chinese artwork in the last 5 years and has been one of the key figures in creating the international bubble of Chinese art. He, when I saw him in March at the Baizhuan, that's a new artistic creative zone in Beijing. We were chatting and I asked him, why do you buy so much of this? And most of it's absolute rubbish. It won't hold value at all. Some of it's fascinating, but we'll see over time what is of value and of interest. And he said, well, you know, I want to buy enough to build a large studio. I'm going to create a massive museum here in Beijing. And I want to leave something for my children. I want to leave them a heritage. And I'm going to buy into China. So he's buying into China. He's a patriot. He wants to be part of the, you know, he trades in China, makes a fortune. And so he's buying into what the authorities also themselves have begun to tax as a creative, part of the creative industries of China. And I said to him, but surely there's so much extraordinary traditional Chinese artwork, amazing calligraphy, true old masters who grow for a fraction of this money. And you could buy, you know, incredible works from anything from Ming Qing dynasties or whatever. And he said, oh, I don't understand that stuff. That's too complicated. And I said, you get this stuff. I say that because 20 years ago, I wrote a piece for a friend in Hong Kong, the Han Art Studio, which is one of the first buyers of mainland Chinese art, run by Johnson Zhang, who was the first big trader in contemporary Chinese art in the early 1990s. He also had a huge exhibition of the stars, those 1979 artists. He had a retrospective exhibition of 1989. And I was asked to write an essay for his catalog. And at that time, I commented, thinking about the future 20 years ago, what it might end up looking like. And I wrote, what perspective does the cultural scene in China allow us today? And this was writing in, it was November 1988, compared to the Beijing Spring, the democracy movement of 1979, the troubled birth of artists and literary self-expression 10 years ago, it's referring back to 1979. What perspective is possible now that the China Art Gallery, that's the gallery, the museum that Claire was mentioning, that I mentioned, that proletarian palace of socialist art, as it makes its halls available to virtually any self-styled avant-garde artist who can afford the rental fee. The end result of China's economic reform and open door may well be the creation of a new kind of avant-garde, an art to order, dissent on tap. And one of the things we have to remember as we look at the boom in Chinese art in the last 10 years in particular, in the international scene, and among people like Budi Tek, is that it is the repressive state, it is the one-party state that has learnt a complex and evolved a complex relationship with its own non-official artists through repression, through freedom, through negotiation, through dialogue, that has created the backdrop for the international success of Chinese art. Their factors are numerous. They go far beyond a simple talk like this today. But one key factor is the fact that China maintains a one-party state that allows enough repression to give artists like Yue Mingjun a type of cultural cachet and validity that in another artistic market they simply wouldn't have. Yue Mingjun's art, to my eyes, is just rubbish of no great interest whatsoever, but A Massacre in Beijing and his oblique references to murder, death, possibility, and uncertainty give his type of artlessness a cachet and a cultural power that otherwise in other realms it simply wouldn't have. So I think it's important to remember that as we think not of all the art. Much of the art I think is really fascinating in other ways, but it's important to remember this political dimension. And in that context, I'd remark on an essay that was published last year in New York when that Tsai Guo-Chang retrospective exhibition was put on at the Guggenheim in early 2008. A writer for the New Republic by the name of Jed Pearl, a very well-known art critic, had the temerity among Western critics to actually question the value of Tsai Guo-Chang's work, its validity, and the relevance of having such a major exhibition at an exhibition space like the Guggenheim. He dared speak truth to the market. People were affronted that this outsider critic, a non-China specialist, what does he know? How dare he comment? Except it's okay if international critics are praiseful of Chinese art, but if they're critical of it, they somehow don't understand. They lack insider knowledge and awareness. Jed Pearl, and I'd encourage you to read his essay. It was called Mao Crazy, published in the New Republic in July 2008. It's very funny, and to my mind, being a person who's observed Chinese art for 35 years, incredibly perceptive. He remarked on the tulip mania-like frenzy that has seen ridiculously inflated reputations and prices reach dizzying heights on the international art bourse. Pearl himself was also boorish enough to reflect on the compromised morality of those on what I would call on the lowdown in China. On the lowdown is an African-American expression meaning straight men who go looking for gay sex. Others, like myself, were intrigued that a non-specialist critic finally had the gumption to comment on the chairman's new clothes, an expression taken from my mentor, Simon Leys, who wrote a book called The Chairman's New Clothes 35 years ago. Departing somewhat from his brief as an art critic, Pearl remarked that the nature and content some of the most popular artwork from mainland China expresses compels one to engage in a political analysis. And this is something that very few critics of contemporary Chinese art do. Much of the work, he observed, was powered by a startling and completely delusionary infatuation with Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution. This is more sinister than anything we have seen in the already fairly astonishing annals of radical chic. And I think it's fascinating that one should reflect and be able to reflect on the constant, complex, and disturbing political dimensions of contemporary Chinese art that's sold internationally, now also popular in China within limited venues, and is also part and parcel of the Chinese official state taxation system. The Chinese authorities in the last 15 years have learned not to repress Chinese art, avant-garde artists, but to tax them. And again, being one of the people who first in the mid-1980s said this is the way that Chinese art will go, sooner or later the state, if it evolves cleverly, and I used a paradigm first developed by a Hungarian dissident, Miklós Harácsi, to talk about velvet prisons, and he said, if the more talented and flexible the state, the more pleasurably it can suck the dissident's vital fluids into the organism of state culture. And I would suggest that we've seen that type of an evolution, as well as the evolution of the international art market over the last 20 or so years. This is not to deny the complex realities of many of the practicing artists in China, but it is something, as we are engaged in the discussion of contemporary Chinese art, we need to remember that there are very complex and disturbing political elements to this type of discussion. These other factors are important that we consider that the really confrontational type of art that might exist, art about Tibet, for example, or Xinjiang, or disturbing art about true poverty and true impoverishment and displacement, is art we don't see very much of. It might sell well internationally, but Chinese artists have learned very much to negotiate a complex relationship with the state. And that's an evolutionary process that's been going on now for 30-odd years. As I said, it's important to remember that. On a more positive note, I'll refer to another type of phenomenon that I find fascinating, and that relates to a discussion that was held by colleagues and friends at the Zendai MoMA gallery. It's a large independent gallery in Shanghai in April last year. A colleague who's a curator who spent many years in Australia, a woman by the name of Huang Fubinghui, who's now back in China, working as a curator at the Zendai MoMA in Shanghai, she organized a workshop called What's Possible? And I thought that was a wonderful title to discuss questions related to Chinese art and possibility, and I was invited to participate, and I did. And one of the topics I took as the center of my discussion was something that's raised by an old friend who worked, Claire just showed us a work, a friend by the name of Geng Jianyi. He was the one who did, what's it called? Second State, there's two screaming faces. Jianyi is a teacher of multimedia and art at the, it's now called the Central Art Academy, isn't it? The Hangzhou one is. The National Academy. I can't remember what they call it in English. It used to be the Hangzhou Art Academy. It's now called the National Art Academy. And Jianyi is still a fascinating experimental artist, but he also trains younger people. And he says he has every year in the last 3 or 4 years, he's had groups of students who are called Jainan and Jainyu in Chinese. The Jainan Jainyu is a Chinese translation of a Japanese term, which is otaku zoku. And these are kids, young people, late teens, early 20s, who've virtually grown up entirely in their parents' apartments. They do not go out. They stay at home. After they finish school, they stay at home. And Jai means home or residence or place. And Nan, male, Nu, female. So boys and girls who don't go out, who are bound to the house, house-bound kids. These are children who grow up with the unstinting love and devotion of six people. That is their parents and two sets of grandparents. They are the darlings, the children, the single children. And they are the future of so much of China. And these children, freighted with the hopes, dreams, and demands of two familial generations, generated by the pitiless politics of the past, many of these young people, in particular the sensitive, quirky, and rebellious, and even the obnoxious, and you meet lots of them, often attempt to disengage entirely from their immediate surroundings. Their phobias, real or imagined, are legion. They hate cement cityscapes of their hometowns, the noisy congestion of every avenue and every place of escape, the alienation from mainstream opinion, zhulumini, as it's called in Chinese. They despise the education system that has been, for them, prescriptive, draconian, and uninspiring. And they despise the media world that's clogged with raucous advertisements and guided thought. The list goes on. But many of them have extraordinary talents. They devote their time to the pursuit of individual vision, whether it be in video games, watching TV, collecting records, Twittering, or you name it. But quite a few of them also pursue an individual artistic vision. And people like Geng Jianyi, these teachers, go out looking for these very talented, extremely quirky, but bizarrely individualistic individual people, and they try and train them in their art schools and bring to light some new talent and possibility within them. And so I think it's important to remember that despite my negative comments about the larger political environment of China, there are also these strange individualistic people who are developing and forming their own artistic vision for the future. They are, in some way, a modern version of those extraordinary, that small but extraordinary group of artists we saw illustrated by Claire's talk, the people of the Wu Minghua Shu, or the Wu Minghua Hui, the no-name artists, who were active in 1966, and throughout the Cultural Revolution, despite all of the official rancor and boisterousness, they were pursuing their own particular artistic visions. In concluding my comments that What's Possible workshop, I said that it's also very difficult to discuss such a topic in China, because I would venture that despite one's best efforts, it is nearly nigh on impossible to calculate what would really be possible in a cultural and intellectual environment like that of China, because circumspection and self-policing are the norm. That is not to say that there are not many who think as freely as possible, and they've created in unfettered ways their own vision in recent years, but I would suggest that we do not and we cannot know what other creative possibilities would result in if any and all that could be imagined were present in the lived realities of China today. Similarly, the lack of an open and self-reflective public media and critical environment has an impact on Chinese art that we cannot understand or appreciate simply because it's there. The censorship, the self-censorship, the constant mediated opinion is something that limits possibility at every turn. No matter how free the exchange of Chinese art and artists is on the international bourse, back at home, those restrictions, complex and subtle they may be, are real, and they do stymie a type of creativity that we will possibly not know for some long time. Meanwhile, there are these Jainan and Jainyu and other types of creative individuals in the provincial cities and towns of China, some in Beijing, not many, most of them are elsewhere in this vast and complex country, who are, dare say, pursuing individualistic and particular artistic visions that we may not know of for many decades, just as we do not know of the artistic activities of the Wuming artists, the no-name artists, until some 30, 40 years after they were first engaged in artistic pursuits. Thank you.
You'll begin to get sick of us coming up to the microphone like this. Great. Look, it's anyone's guess what the future will hold, but I guess in order to give you some idea of the way in which Chinese artists have changed in the past, I thought I'd just quickly choose five artists and look at some earlier work and look at some more recent work as a way of indicating, you know, the types of changes that have happened in the recent past, as a way of then perhaps you know, extrapolating what might be possible in the future. And the first artist I wanted to look at very briefly was Zhang Xiaogang. I showed you one of his works made just after 1989. This is a work from a similar period, very small in scale, worked in pencil, applied fabric, wanting to inject a, you know, kind of sense of reality into the image. There's a considered sort of physicality. And his recent work, well, from 2006, huge in scale, titled Boy with Eyes Closed, from his Amnesia and Memory series. It has an airbrushed kind of quality, reflecting a very strong awareness of global art trends. And, of course, his appreciation of the work of the German artist Gerhard Richter in particular. So quite a dramatic sort of shift over a 10, 15-year period on his part. And if you look at this work closely, you know, here Zhang Xiaogang's focused all of the attention on a single face. You know, the boy appears to be floating, there's no context. He's in a dreamlike state, and yet there are tears that you can see forming beneath his closed eyes, suggesting trouble of some kind. Zhang Xiaogang himself has commented on the rapidity of development in China. Demolition, he said, had caused many people's memories to be erased, leaving them suspended in a state of remembering and forgetting. Xu Bing, whose work you're familiar with now, like Zhang Xiaogang, was academy trained. This is arguably the most significant work from the second half of the 20th century. After more than a decade in the States, he returned to live and work in Beijing in 2007 and accepted a job as deputy director at the Central Academy of Fine Art in Beijing, where he trained. So quite an interesting example of an artist who's left China and then been lured back. While he was in the States, Xu Bing created many language-based works, but working with English rather than Chinese, none of them nearly as successful as this work, Book from the Sky. These are some icons that are from his new work titled Book from the Ground, which was displayed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Not in this form, I couldn't get an image of it, but these are some of the internationally accepted icons that we're all familiar with, which he creates a language out of. In commenting on his move back to China in 2000, Xu Bing said, "There are things here," meaning China, "that don't exist within the Western realm, which is what causes me to appreciate what we have experienced in this country. We must face our own past. You cannot be in complete denial about what has happened. If we deny things completely, then we have nothing." So there is this sense of a need for people, particularly those whose work is strongly based in language, to return to China and to contribute what they've learnt from their stints overseas, but also to create new work that relates to the new situation that they find themselves in China. I wanted to get a woman in here, and this is the work of Chen Haiyan, who's a printmaker from Hangzhou, and this is from one of her Dream series in 1986. You know, an interest in the subconscious, She'd read Jung and Freud, but really her interest in dreams is a desire on her part to have total control of her own creative expression and constructing a self-contained and self-referential world in which she doesn't need to rely on external society for any of her creative input. And these are some of her recent works. She's someone who's never left China. She hasn't lived for an extended period overseas. You can see that text is a big part of her work. She records her dreams every morning or whenever she's had them in image and text. And so she is not one of the artists whose work has been informed by the Western art market at all. I'm showing you work by her just to show that there is such a huge diversity of practice that is happening and contemporary practice. So here she's moved from woodblock prints to carving directly into the wood itself. These are large-scale panels that can be installed on the gallery walls. Shen Xiaomin, who spent 10 years in Australia, this is an early print that he made in 1986. He was a professional artist with a strong reputation in China and then spent 10 difficult years in Australia, never mastered English, never was able to crack the art scene in Australia, suffered from what the critic Wu Hong has called aphasia, an inability, you know, to speak. I mean, an inability to communicate in English. So the 10 years he spent here, he was a house painter, he did all sorts of odd jobs, didn't do anything artistically. But after he went back from China, he's had this amazing transformation and has done, well, I'm not particularly fond of the work, but I'm showing it to you just as an example of the transformation that's happened creating these installations using animal bones and ground bones that are reconstituted to create these very strange creatures, otherworldly creatures. And finally, Aixian, who also has an Australian connection. He's someone who came to Australia in 1989 as a refugee. He created this work in 1986 in China, an oil-painted work. And it's called Jui Antrian, you know, beware of your safety. And he's was regarded as a dissident artist. He was self-taught. He was under constant surveillance, you know, in the late 1980s. And that was one of his reasons for wanting to leave China at the time. He came to Sydney. He's still living here. His family's here. But he goes back to China and creates works like this. You might have seen his porcelain body casts or a carved lacquer body cast. There are examples in the collection of the National Gallery of Victoria and many other state museums. This is one of his very recent works called Metaphysica. It's cast in bronze, originally from a body cast, where he's brought together life casts and these found objects, fake objects that he's found in markets in China, to create contemplative works that are quietly moving forward, you know, aesthetically and in artistic terms, but with an acknowledgement of what has come before and what has been lost and what has been changed and remade. I mean, very much like his own life, which is divided between Sydney and Beijing. Oh, sorry. I wanted to finish with this work, which was by Ai Weiwei, who was the architectural curator of the Bird's Nest Stadium. And this is from the now familiar Fuck Off exhibition that I've mentioned from 2000. It's a work called Perspective Washington and Perspective Beijing. And I think they, all of the works that I've shown you, both old and new, are informed, you know, by very complex and changing circumstances that Chinese artists have found themselves in over the last 30 years. Many of the works operate on multiple levels and simultaneously. Ambiguity and having a buck each way has been a hallmark, you know, of the art of contemporary Chinese art, but also of the art of or ambiguity has been a hallmark of Chinese intellectuals for hundreds of years. Artists have long functioned as the hearts and minds of society, their attention finely tuned to interpret, you know, the heartbeat and the pulse of the world around them. And so I expect that in the way Premier Wen Jiabao used the phrase confidence, China confidence, he said, is more precious than gold or currency, China, of course, has plentiful reserves of gold and currency, and who would have guessed that 30 years ago, communist China, China's socialist market economy would be propping up the economy of capitalist America. But I imagine that China's reserves of confidence are going to continue, and that we are destined to witness and experience much more of it, as well as nuanced and not so nuanced artistic reflections of that confidence in the years ahead. Thank you.
Now, thank you to Claire and Jeremy. Now, as we head into questions, a couple of points. We have ushers here with roving microphones. So by all means, catch my eye, but then wait for a microphone and speak your question into that so as we can all hear it. Please identify yourself for the record. And also, if you have a question specifically to Claire or Jeremy, direct it to them. And I'm sure we'll get a lot of dialogue going. There's our first, and there's someone just about to hit you with the microphone, and off we go. Thank you.
Brian Fuller. I don't have any particular interest in art, but the last slide there indicated a degree of sarcasm sort of in art, and if I can hark back to another field you haven't touched, cartoonists. I don't suspect there's any Tanberg-type cartoonists around, but maybe there are. Any comments, please?
Well, whilst those two are tossing the coin, come on. Talk about a buck each way.
Well, look, cartoon work, I mean, there is a long, you know, tradition of interesting sort of cartooning and politically inflected, you know, cartooning. You know, and I'm thinking back to the 20s and 30s and the period pre-1949 in particular. I guess it doesn't, within the Chinese kind of concept of art, cartooning doesn't really fit within the concept of fine art and everything. You know, there's such a hierarchy, you know, of the different artistic genres. So I suppose that's why, you know, I haven't referred to it, and you don't see it represented in exhibitions. It seems to be, you know, to have a kind of, you know, occupy category, you know, of its own. But yes, the work by Ai Weiwei that I showed you, it could be a cartoon, and I think a lot of the artwork does try to get away with, you know, the artists try and get away with as much as they possibly can without crossing, you know, a line that's going to get them into trouble, you know, and Ai Weiwei is a master, you know, of that, and you know, I think, you know, if you look at those works on the one hand, and then you look at his role as architectural curator of the Bird's Nest Stadium on the other, I mean, that is a very, you know, he is a wonderful example, you know, of what is possible in China and the very close relationships, you know, that can exist, you know, that Jeremy was talking about, you know, between the dissident artists, you know, and the state in the contemporary situation. There's been a desire, you know, to woo people back and bring them into the fold, and they are given a certain amount of latitude, but they know the boundaries.
There's one in the centre there.
Hello, my name is Ellen Koshland. I actually would love to just tease out a little bit of this thing around restriction, because I was lucky enough, first of all, to see Chinese art at the Saatchi Gallery. And when I walked in, I was knocked out, first of all, by the quality of imagination. And I feel that that is profound in all the Chinese work I've seen. It's highly individual and between people. And so, I mean, I don't think you can get a more unrestricted piece of work than that fuck you picture. And I would wonder if there aren't some payoffs, because in our society where supposedly it's very unrestricted, first of all, I think there is art fashion that is very restrictive on people. But second of all, where it's supposedly, there seems to me a loss of energy that possibly when you show the open door policy through a metaphor, when you use imagination, there's a quality that is of huge benefit to the art. So I guess I'm wondering about, if you really think about restriction, how much is there also a plus and a minus of working around supposed tenets of prohibition?
Indeed, it's the old argument, it's a very old argument related to this, is when everything is possible, nothing really happens. And when things are not possible, true creativity is possible, or easier. It's an argument made much easier by us who live in a completely unrestricted environment. And it's also one that leads very easily to a certain type of condescension to Chinese artists who do, regardless of my own views of the political problems in China, live with real restrictions. You try and do certain things and you will be closed down, you will be jailed, you will be banned, your work will not be available. That's a reality. Now, if that energizes many other artists and we indulge and enjoy their energized artistic creativity, that's very nice for us, it's very nice for them, but we are talking about the freedoms and possibilities of the spirit without fetter, and that we can enjoy the possibilities of a restricted society in a Saatchi environment or a Western cultural environment is fascinating and delightful. I am more interested in the more absolute possibilities for those artists and creative figures who aren't always free and don't even know what the freedoms are. I've known over the last 35, 40 years of my life artists and writers whose lives have been destroyed by their attempts to express things that are not possible. And there are generations of them. And there are young people also who suffer from this. Weiwei was in America. He produced this work in America. There's a third panel to a later version of this work with Hong Kong, the Hong Kong harbor, and him sticking up his finger in the Hong Kong harbor. And I use this as an image, actually, in a book I did 10 years ago. And Weiwei is one of those wonderful figures who actually has become a bellwether for China. He's the only artist who is so outspokenly critical of the Chinese government, who is not banned or harassed by the authorities. In fact, those of us who've known Weiwei, I've known him for 30 years, I knew his father was a very well-known Communist Party member, and I think Weiwei is one of those fascinating and delightful characters who's also wonderfully cynically manipulated and found a way to cope and live with China. And the Chinese authorities, one speculates, and people in Beijing speculate, that his freedom is possible because the authorities decide we need one or two. We need one or two to just show how free we are, so we'll leave them alone. But we'll control and tell the others how they're not that free. So again, it's a complex situation. We can delight in restricted freedoms of the Chinese to produce a sort of energized art, but is that not a problem for us as well, to be aware of, oh, their art is interesting because it is the result of a type of a repression, and that brings out a certain type of creative energy? That's true, but at the same time, it also helps us reflect back on what our freedoms have deprived us of, perhaps. So one easily gets into philosophical ruminations, but it's a very complex problem that you've raised, and I can't answer it too easily in this short. I wrote a whole book about this subject called In the Red that tries to talk about just this problem, and it's extremely difficult.
I mean, Chris, I might just make one quick comment, and that is that not all of the works, of course, are shown in China. They're not all exhibited in China. Like the Yue Mingjun execution, you know, painting, that has never been shown in China. I mean, and so it's just not possible. So the things that we see in the Saatchi Gallery or, you know, overseas collections or exhibitions, just because they're there doesn't necessarily mean that they were exhibited or can be exhibited openly, you know, in China. And having said that, you know, the situation there has changed dramatically, but it's still not possible to show everything.
Now, there's a question in the middle there. There we go.
Just a basic question to Jeremy. The presentation is about contemporary Chinese art. Exactly, historically, how do you frame or how do you set what sort of time frame does contemporary here include? And then in terms of Chinese art, contemporary Chinese art, all I've seen is actually paintings and some other installations. So are these the contents of the presentation you made?
Well, I think that the brief that we had is to discuss the art that has risen since the initiation of what's called the Open Door and Reform Policies of 1978. So we've spoken today about the art of the last 30 years. If you speak in Chinese about contemporary Chinese art, that's a whole other discussion because time is delineated differently in Chinese. Contemporary Chinese art in China, the People's Republic of China, not Taiwan, not Hong Kong, is art produced after 1949. That is art produced under the aegis of the Chinese Communist Party and its People's Republic of China. That's called Dang Dai Yishu. But we've discussed a contemporary art as delineated from the opening up and reform policies of 1978. For me, modern, I'm more interested in the whole flow of modern Chinese art from the 1880s to now. But that's a whole other discussion that we just haven't had time for.
I mean, if I could just add, what we haven't touched on at all here is brush and ink painting, traditions of Chinese painting that is continuing in the contemporary period. But in China, it has not been included really fully within the definition of contemporary Chinese art practice, which has tended to look to the West and, be regarded as West-looking, so-called avant-garde, experimental art practice, as opposed to traditional practice. So that has been the thrust of the contemporary art movement in China. But now there is a tendency, to broaden that and realize that, in fact, what China has to offer, is much greater than that.
Oh, there's a question down the front.
Okay, thank you. As a Chinese, I always feel very, painful to, when I look at the contemporary Chinese art. Because maybe, the first time when I, saw those, pictures, especially, by Fang Lijun, with those, person with those faces, weird color, that pink color and the shining oil painting, I always feel painful because, once you crack the code, it's just, all the real life or the real feeling of Chinese people or, I'm a little bit, nervous. How Chinese people's life really is, we are forced to laugh and we are forced to do something and, it's just like a person is made of china or porcelain. There's no inside, no soul, no real life. I always feel painful. But anyway, I think it's good for those artists. They try to find, their language to express their feelings to the Chinese culture or, in a certain force, the life in a certain time. And thank you very much, for, collecting Chinese, paintings and try to, show, Chinese culture to, Australians. But may I ask, is there a negative part, for the way you, people who collect, paintings? Because, we can see you just, collect, the works, by a certain, painters or, in a certain way.
Jeremy, do you want to tackle that one? Because I think you've touched on some of those contradictions in your...
I'm happy to... Do you want to say that? Yeah. Well, I think not everything that I showed is stuff that we, that has been collected in Australia. What I really wanted to do was, in a very short space of time, cover through selected artworks, an artistic kind of, journey, that has been... that can explain the kind of practice that has been undertaken by key artists, over the last 30 years. So I guess they're all major figures and they're major artworks included in major exhibitions. So I guess I've exercised, you know, some, you know, curatorial kind of choice in putting that together. But and I wasn't particularly looking, you know, to represent, you know, contemporary Chinese art, you know, an artist's view of contemporary culture in a bad light. But I mean, it's just sort of how it is.
But just like, I mean, but in the questioner's comments and your earlier response to the previous, is there a risk that there is really an enormous gulf between the artwork as circulated, viewed, collected, bought, say, in Australia, and a similar motif viewed in China? I mean, I felt that thread through you both of your presentations, that there were really almost two universes there, and artists and objects that traverse the two, meaning entirely different things in each.
Mm. Mm. Do you want to have a go?
Well, indeed, and it's in the past they were completely bifurcated. In China, in the 1980s, one could speak of there being virtually a culture of the foreign salon, because Chinese artworks were only shown in diplomats' apartments or by businessmen and businesswomen, people who bought and exhibited works only for themselves. It was entirely a foreign art market feeding off underground dissident Chinese art. That's changed dramatically in the last 25 years or 20 years or so. And in recent years, you've seen more and more Chinese critics and more Chinese entrepreneurs and buyers enter the market and actually begin to develop collections within China and allow this work, not all of it, as Claire was saying, a lot of Ye Mingjun's work is unseeable in China, as is a lot of other work, but there are more and more opportunities for this work to circulate within China and become part of the complex cultural conversations within China itself. But that's a relatively recent development. Mm. And there's a lot that will happen in the next 5 to 10 years. But it is, we've seen these two entirely different art audiences and markets gradually growing closer together in recent times.
And indeed, if you look, for example, at Lu Peng's book on history of 20th century Chinese art, virtually every image that I showed you today, you know, has come from that book, is in that book. I mean, it is the art history that is being, you know, written about, recognised, you know, as you know, the recent art history. And I think, as Jeremy says, that has come together. But I think there is a great disjunction, and there is yet another kind of world of art making, you know, that is other than what is regarded as avant-garde, you know, which isn't particularly well documented or understood, you know, in the West.
If I could also add to in keeping with that, there's a Chinese official state-controlled and sponsored art production in every area. And there's massive amounts of oil painting and other sculptures and so on, so produced under the aegis of the Ministry of Culture and its various bureaus throughout the country, far in excess of any of the avant-garde artwork. Tons and tons and tons of work. And within that, there's a great deal of talent, there's a great deal of variety, and that art is invisible to us, because it's official state art, therefore it disappears. And perhaps 10, 20, 30 years from now, there'll be major international exhibitions of that type of art that has been completely occluded by this avant-garde art. And that'll be a fascinating thing to see, because now in recent years, people have begun to recognise the official art of the 1950s and 60s as being a valid part of Chinese art history. Mm. And therefore the same thing will be happening in the future of the art that's being produced today.
And many of the artists whose work I mentioned, they're all graduates from the key art academies in China. I mean, they're serious practitioners, acknowledged as.
Mm. Now, I think we've got time for one more question, and I can see a hand up at the back there.
Hi, Jane Brownrigg. From what you've said, I'm just wondering if there's a sense of a kind of symbiosis that the avant-garde artists need the Western spotlight for a kind of protection so that they can't be disappeared, and whether they in turn sort of focus their artworks to things that they imagine the West might be interested in, and if that has sort of had any kind of lasting or profound effect on what they focus on and why.
Well, indeed, you've touched on one of the most complex elements of contemporary Chinese artistic practice from the 80s onwards, when a lot of international artwork was introduced or reintroduced into China through publications and exhibitions. Robert Rauschenberg's visit to China, what was it, 1985, had a profound, extraordinary impact on China, and the growing awareness of Chinese artists of the international, not only marketplace, but first the international exhibition space, and catering to the international audience, just as Chinese filmmakers, to a great extent, in the 1980s, 85, 6, 7, 8, really did pander incredibly to a small group of international film festival directors. I know many of those directors and know the artists who were pandering to their tastes. But so there has been that symbiotic relationship, and it's been profound and complex. But that's changed dramatically in the last 10 or 20 years, because you have exhibitions in Hong Kong and Taiwan and the rest of Southeast Asia and Asia generally, the biennials throughout the world. You have a lot of complex interactions between Chinese-based practitioners in the international market, and that symbiosis has become far more complex and subtle. And there's also the biennials in China that are curated and run by Chinese and international curators. So what was a fairly simple and obvious type of relationship in the 80s has become far more nuanced and complex. Though, as you just mentioned, there are these very, very difficult lines of delineation that one has to follow if one really wants to understand how a certain artist produces and evolves a style. And then one can, as one's seen with Claire's comments, how they've developed also, many artists have developed a very unique voice that originally reacting to the international market has also grown and developed into something mature and completely of itself.
Yeah. Johnson Chang, you know, Zhang Cunren, who runs Han Art Gallery, you know, in Hong Kong, has played an incredibly important role in bringing contemporary Chinese experimental artwork, you know, to international audiences, and that suited the Chinese, you know, the Chinese artists in the 1980s and 1990s, you know, because it was what they wanted. They wanted international exposure. And Johnson, through his exhibitions in Hong Kong, and they travelled to Sydney, and they've gone all over the world, created quite a stir in the 1990s. But as time has gone on, there has become a disenchantment. Chinese artists and curators and gallery people have become increasingly disenchanted with the West and, you know, that whole relationship, and wanted greater ownership of it themselves. 1993 was the first year that Chinese artists were included in the Venice Biennale. And it was the same artists, pretty much, that Zhang Xiaogang had launched onto the international stage, you know, out of Hong Kong. Olivia, Achille Bonita Olivia, who curated that Venice Biennale and included contemporary Chinese artists for the first time. The Venice Biennale, the 53rd Venice Biennale, is on now, and China now has an official national pavilion. They have for the last 3 years. And there also is also an invitational exhibition that was curated by Liu Peng, who I mentioned, who wrote this impressive history of 20th century Chinese art. He's curated it in association with Olivia. And so it's quite interesting. In the Chinese sort of press releases, there's no mention of Olivia, it's just Liu Peng. But Olivia is there as an old friend of China, who was the first person to actually introduce contemporary Chinese artists to the international audience. But with the Venice Biennale this year, the China official pavilion, and also this invitational exhibition, pretty much it has the hands of Chinese artists and curators all over it, but also of Chinese officialdom. So look, it's a very interesting, you know, situation now. Chinese artists and curators and gallerists have wanted to wrest control of the interpretation of their own art, and great. I mean, it was just that people in the West were fascinated and had opportunities to assist with that promotion. Now that situation, you know, as Jeremy said, has become more complex. I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what happens. One of the key elements, ironically, of this invitational exhibition, which was supposed to be a non-official Chinese exhibition, was a traditional Chinese garden, you know, a traditional Chinese garden, and the artworks were arrayed around this traditional Chinese garden. You know, so, you know, there, and the exhibition was called A Gift to Marco Polo, So there is this desire for Chinese to engage in an international dialogue, you know, in reverse, as it were, but to put something of traditional Chinese culture at the heart of it. So I think we're seeing an interesting shift in terms of the emphasis of contemporary Chinese art and an opening out of what that might be. And that, I think, is part of a greater Chinese official involvement, but also a greater awareness of the sort of unofficial players understanding, you know, that there needs to be a coming together of these various worlds.
Well, thank you, Claire. That's pointed us well and truly in the direction of the future. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've been to Venice. I'll cash in that plane ticket and not go now. Thank you, Jeremy and Claire, for your comments and for your very generous responses to the questions. And thank you to the audience for your attention and your very astute dialogue with the speakers. Will you join me in applauding our two presenters?